Hello, and welcome to an intelligent look at terrorism. This podcast is brought to you by Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting in Ottawa, Canada. I am Phil Gursky, President and CEO of Borealis. This is recorded on the 9th of April, 2020, and I am quite thrilled to have with me on the phone Mr. Ward Elcock, whom I know quite well because he was my director when I worked at the Canadian Security Intelligence Service in Canada, or CSIS as it's known, from 2001 to 2015. Mr. Elcock was also deputy clerk at the Security Intelligence Secretariat in the Privy Council Office and also a deputy minister in national defense before he retired from the civil service. So, Ward, welcome to the podcast.
No, it's a pleasure to be with you, Phil.
So, as I noted, you were the director of CSIS from 94 to 2004. You are, I believe, the only person to do two complete terms with CSIS. Is that correct?
That's right.
So you were a trooper of nothing else. But the question I want to ask you is that you took over in 1994 and you lasted till 2004. When you were made director of CSIS in 1994, what was the world like and what was the service like? You know, going back now, what, 26 years ago?
By that point in time, it was 10 years old. In fact, the summer I joined, one of the first things that I participated in was the sort of 10th anniversary of the service. So the service was a relatively young organization. It had changed from the RCMP culture in the sense that it had had 10 years of hiring not from outside the RCMP. A lot of the senior officers were still former RCMP officers, but the nature of the service had changed dramatically. And it had also changed because when the service left the RCMP, it had no administration, no structure beyond the intelligence officers that went with the service. So the whole service, in a sense, had to be built after it left the RCMP, a whole new structure, a whole new way of doing things, a whole new way of operating had to be built. So the service was, while it was still young, it had begun to take on its own personality, a new personality, if you will, from being part of the originally the RCMP. The world too was very different in the sense that at that point in time the major issues were still counterintelligence. There were issues around counterterrorism. Counterterrorism was becoming more important. It had been with the downing of Air India that started to become more important, but it was not anywhere near the focus it became over the next 4 or 5 years. But it was still, counterintelligence was still the major focus, to the point that I think that with the collapse of the Soviet Union not too long after I joined the service in 94, people did for a while wonder if we were going to have an issue, whether there would be anything for the service to do, because counterintelligence was such a big part of what service had historically done as part of the RCMP, and then when it became a separate organization. And it looked like there was not going to be any more counterintelligence work. Now, that's changed again, but for a while, we all did wonder for about a year or two until things started to pick up in counterterrorism. People did wonder what was going to happen.
It's interesting to hear you say that because I couldn't agree with you more. I was at CSE, Communications Security Establishment, when you took over as the director of CSIS. And I recall this being, as you said, the post-Cold War period. And CSE was very much a Cold War organization, started after World War II. And when I joined CSE in 1983, I think I was one of 12 people out of 1,000 that did not do the Soviet Union Warsaw Pact. We were called the Rest of the World Desk back then. And I think when the wall fell, a lot of people were asking the same questions that you alluded to. What do we do now? What's our focus? So as the 90s progressed, and we got things like the Rassam case in 2000, and we had other snippets here and there. Of course, we had the Khadr family joining up with Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan in the late 80s and 90s. Was it a bit of a learning curve or a challenge for the service to integrate, understand, and fully investigate the terrorism challenge, which, as you said, was there back to Air India in 85, but from an organizational perspective, Was it really difficult to get the investigators to wrap their heads around a very different focus, moving from counterintelligence to counterterrorism?
There's no question that there's a difference in counterterrorism work, and it's not necessarily easy to jump from one to the other. It's not that they aren't the same kind of exercise, frankly. I think it took some time, but I think the service had a couple of advantages. One, technologically, the service had put a lot of effort into making technological progress. People are expensive; they were becoming expensive even in that time. And so the service had put a fair amount of effort, more than most, into developing its technological capability. I think that gave the service a large edge. I mean, I've seen a lot of other services, including some that are much larger and in theory more capable, who were never were not even some years after the World Trade Center attack, still did not have the technological capabilities that we did, allowed full database searching and so on and so forth, which was important for counterintelligence, but even in a sense, even more important for counterterrorism. So I think we had a technological leap. I think the other reality too was people were glad to know that they had that the organization had a future. And I think people it took a little time for people to find their feet in a new kind of operating environment, but I think people found it relatively quickly. And we did, as I said, have a couple of advantages. But one of the advantages as well being we were still a relatively new service. So we didn't have a lot of ingrained habits and a lot of ingrained ways of doing things. And I think that also helped the service make faster progress.
When you talk about there being a distinct difference between counterintelligence and counterterrorism investigations, I'm going to go and say that that is, and correct me if I'm wrong, when you're doing counterintelligence, they're often very long investigations. You're looking to see who are the actors and what are they doing. And most times, you're aiming towards perhaps declaring somebody persona non grata and getting them out of the country because they're a foreign diplomat doing things they shouldn't. Whereas in counterterrorism, you're looking at people who are actually planning to carry out acts of violence, which may in fact kill Canadians. Is that sort of the way that the service sort of migrated from looking at things through from a counterintelligence lens to a counterterrorism lens? And then how did that affect the relationship with the RCMP? Because at the end of the day, it's the RCMP that has to, in a sense, take over to gather evidence to lay charges and go to court. The service doesn't do that kind of thing. So is that how counterterrorism was different than counterintelligence?
I think that is that's certainly one of the differences, the reality that counterterrorism is about things going bump in the night, and there is an immediacy to the investigations that, in some sense, in a counterintelligence investigation, you don't have, because, as you say, they can be much longer investigations. They may take years to bear fruit, and in fact, you may never know that you successfully did a counterintelligence operation by arresting somebody or whatever. You may just lead to an operation in which you watch people, or you feed them false information, or you try and all sorts of different options. So yeah, there's the immediacy is a huge difference. And I that was a big driver in the service making progress on counterterrorism. It did. The reality of the relationship with the RCMP, I think it's much improved in the last while. I think the service and the RCMP have found ways to manage some of the issues. The issues, though, really actually, I mean, in part, they came out of the different cultures of the two organizations. One collecting intelligence, the other collecting evidence for prosecutions. There was some tension around that, but the real tension came from a constitutional problem, which is that if you're being prosecuted for a crime, including terrorism, you're entitled to disclosure of all of the Crown's case. And the instant that CSIS was involved, or it became clear that CSIS was involved, then sources and methods that the service might use, which the RCMP might not have access to, could be forced to be disclosed. So it made it very difficult for us to provide information to the RCMP in some cases, and for the RCMP in some cases to accept it, because if they accepted it, they didn't know if it would contaminate their case. They didn't know for sure that we would come along later and say, no, you can't reveal that information because of the way it was collected or the source that collected or whatever. So that constitutional problem, and we're not the only country that deals with a similar problem, but it is a serious problem, was a serious problem in Canada. I think that the service and the RCMP have found ways to manage it. Doesn't mean that there aren't still some tensions. And the reality is there have to be some tensions because it is by definition, you don't want an easy gap where there is a, you know, you things can fall between the RCMP and CSIS. You do want a certain amount of overlap, and a certain amount of overlap by definition means a certain amount of tension and conflict.
It's interesting you talk about disclosure. Of course, there's an ongoing court case here in Ottawa you may be aware of, involving a man called Elso Peshtari, who has been charged with facilitating people going to join ISIS in Iraq and Syria. And the defense has asked for all of the CSIS records in the case of an individual who later became an RCMP agent but was first a CSIS source. And you allude to those difficulties that, you know, CSIS does not collect evidentiary standards and it doesn't want its information to be disclosed in court. So I agree with you, it's getting better, but this is still an ongoing issue. If I can go
Oh,
back.
and you're right. It is still it hasn't disappeared, but I think they have found that the service, the RCMP, have found ways to manage some of those issues.
And I'm really glad to hear that because, you know, both agencies obviously have their mandates and they have their places in the counterterrorism slash counterintelligence slash keeping us safe
Oh,
sort of
absolutely,
world.
absolutely.
If I can go back to 9/11, I remember I was still a secondee from CSC at CSIS at the time. I remember where I was and what it meant for me, and I remember the next month being very much of a blur. What are your memories of when 9/11 happened and the service's response to, like, when they were being told to, you know, leave no stone unturned to find out if there were first of all, any Canadian links to 9/11, and secondly, what the landscape was here in our country? What are your memories of those sort of weeks and months following 9/11?
I remember the morning of 9/11. I think, in fact, we were briefing the new chief of CSE that morning when somebody came in and said, you should turn on the TV. There's been an attack on the World Trade Center. I think the reality, I mean, I think people, society tends to look at the World Trade Center as the beginning of serious terrorist problems, issues, with groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. I think the reality for the service was the attack, none of us knew that where the attack would take place. None of us knew would be, no one knew how it would look or whatever. But I remember that feeling that morning. This is what we have been expecting for some time. There had been a lot of chatter for some time about the possibility of an operation going on. Nobody knew what it was, as I said, but everybody knew that something was in the works, that something was coming, and it was not unexpected. And in a sense, I mean, for the service, although for society, I think that was the beginning of Al-Qaeda, or people's understanding of the existence of Al-Qaeda, the reality is it had started earlier for the service. But you alluded to some of the cases. But a lot of folks had come to Canada, particularly out of North Africa and particularly into Montreal. You talked about Ahmed Rossam, but there had been others. So we had already had some connection to those kinds of investigations. We already knew that it existed. We already knew that it was an issue. A number of services, the French in particular, were repeatedly telling us that this was a serious issue and a serious problem for the future. So it wasn't entirely a surprise, but I can still remember that morning.
I do recall the professionalism of the IOs and everyone else at the service who basically just put their noses to the grindstone and worked as long as they had to. Because, you know, I remember that, you know, one of the fears was, God forbid there was a Canadian connection to the 19 hijackers. That would have been a really problematic issue for, I think, bilaterally. But I think that, as you said, this has been going on for a while with the North Africans, especially in Montreal, and a whole bunch of cases, that it didn't take us all by surprise. I remember there being a reporting line in SIGINT. It was called the UBL network, and we all thought, well, who's the UBL network? But you're right.
Yeah.
We've been following this for quite some time.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. That was the first thought. First thing that we set out to do is we wanted to find out where everybody was that we were worried about. Secondly, we wanted to make sure that there was no connection to Canada to the event. And there were, and have still, there's still all today, people in the United States who think that some of the attackers came through Canada. In fact, none of them did. They all went through to the United States legitimately and set up their operation inside the United States. Nobody ever translated through Canada at all. But there was a rumor for a little while that one of the groups had flown in through Maine or into Boston from Canada. But even that was ultimately disproved. But there was a huge effort to try and make sure that was in fact the case, that there was no link to Canada.
Actually, Hillary Clinton, when she was running for president against Donald Trump, she was one of the ones that raised the rumor again. This was in 2016, so 15 years later, that in fact some had come through Canada. I want to change tack a little bit here, Ward. And you know, you spent a whole career in security intelligence, grossly speaking, as did I. If I were to ask you, how well do you think Canadians appreciate or understand threats to public safety and national security? How are we doing as a country on that scope?
I don't think Canadians do. I think they occasionally, the concerns about security, national security, will spike in the event of an attack close to home or major attacks in other parts of the world that we're familiar with. But I don't think, for the most part, that Canadians do feel particularly concerned about national security. I mean, it's a long time since the Russians posed a military threat to Canada, to North America, if you will. We have three oceans surrounding us, basically, and the United States to our south. Most Canadians, I think, perceive themselves as living in a safe enclave from the rest of the world, from the problems of the rest of the world. I don't think that that's strictly speaking true. But having said that, I think that's what most Canadians believe.
Now, is that a good thing, a bad thing, or both or neither, that Canadians don't obsess about national security and public safety? I think we would agree that we want them to think about it occasionally and to acknowledge the group that's the work that CSIS and the RCMP and its partners do. But the fact that it's not headline news for most Canadians, where would you put that in terms of sort of how Canadians see themselves and how they see the world?
In truth, it's not entirely unrealistic. I mean, the reality is Canada did not suffer a really major attack, not despite the fact that it was named both by ISIS and Al-Qaeda as a potential target. Canada never suffered a really serious attack. So in some sense, Canadians are right that this is a pretty safe place to be. Having said that, it is not entirely safe. You never can be sure that there won't be an attack if there are major terrorist groups operating or if there is a military threat from somewhere. So I guess the $64 million question is whether it's just that Canadians feel safe or that nobody has really explained to Canadians that indeed there are risks in the world and that they have a potential, they can do potential harm to Canada, sometimes indirectly, but perhaps even directly, and that therefore we need to worry more about those things. And it's true both of sort of national security issues in the sense of CSIS, the RCMP, CSD, but national defense as well. I think Canadians struggle with the idea of of funding the military to the extent that it needs to be funded. Just as they probably aren't really sure how much value it actually brings because they feel relatively safe. Is it a question of leadership or is it just Canadians' feelings? I've never been quite sure. I think I would like to see Canadians more concerned. I would like to see our political leaders more concerned about some of those issues and speaking to Canadians more about some of those issues. And perhaps that would lead to a broader understanding by Canadians of the impact of our national security risks and threats that they care about.
I want to pick up on that because in the aftermath of 9/11, as I'm sure you remember, we all made out like bandits in terms of money and resources. When I left CSC to join the service in 2001, it was about 1,000 strong, and now I understand it's somewhere north of 3,000. The service also got a lot of money and resources. A lot more training classes were held for intelligence officers per se. Given that the threats that you've alluded to are mutating as we speak, so of course counterterrorism is still a priority. Counterintelligence, which many may have thought was dead, is rearing its ugly head. Foreign interference is becoming much more of a concern here in Canada from a variety of actors. There's the whole cyber angle, which is maybe largely a CSE responsibility, but the service has a role to play there as well. Do you fear that the combination of Canadians' lackadaisical attitude towards national security, and you also mentioned the government, and I happen to agree with you on that. I worked in this area for more than 3 decades, and I was sometimes appalled at how little Canadian officials understood intelligence and the importance of it. Do you fear going forward, and maybe now we're talking Corona, the COVID-19 pandemic, that people will argue for less money being spent and less resources on national security in a time where, in fact, you need more because the multiplicity of threats. It's not just terrorism as it has been for the past 20 years. As I said, counterintelligence and nefarious actors are rising. Is that a scenario that's possible going forward in Canada where we get less rather than more?
As a result of the pandemic, I assume that the belts are going to be tightened going down the road, given the increase in the deficit that will inevitably come. So it may well be that there will be pressure to reduce budgets, even for national security. I would hope that the budgets for national security, whether it's the military or CSIS and the RCMP, are not tightened too much because, as you said, I mean, there are legitimate threats out there. Counterintelligence, as you said, has begun to rear its ugly head. The Chinese have been operating here for years, and the issues of around foreign interference. If you read the press in Australia and New Zealand, and I think there's almost no reason to think that the same things don't go on here. The degree of foreign interference by the Chinese is considerable. So I would hope that we don't see huge reductions in budgets, but it would be I would be na I think we'd all be naive to think that there won't be pressure on all budgets as a consequence of the deficit that will be the fallout from the pandemic.
The figures are clearly almost impossible to understand, as you mentioned, with what the government's spending to prop up the unemployed and things like that. Lastly, Ward, I just want to ask you, this may be an unfair question to ask at the spur of the moment, but you spent a long time in security intelligence in this country, and what would you say, if you could look back and pick out a couple highlights for you that sort of unraveled during your career? What is it that you can point back and say, wow, we did a great job on that, and Canada, as a result, is a safer country?
I think we did a very good job on the lead up to and the aftermath of the attack on the World Trade Center. In other words, the sort of peak of Al-Qaeda. Most of those investigations obviously don't get talked about, and you can't really explain to the public the successes in many cases. But I think we did a great job. I was certainly very proud of the organization and the people working in it, and what we did through those years. I think we took the organization a long way from where it had started in 1994. through those years. The one I sort of had, it's a smaller case, but the one I always kind of enjoyed the most, I think, probably was the two Russian illegals who were arrested in, I think it was 95 and 96, and by the RCMP in Toronto. I mean, that is a spectacular case. It was a spectacular case. And if you could tell that story, it would be probably one of the better spy movies that you could put on the screen. But unfortunately, it probably will never get told, at least not in my lifetime. But that was certainly one of the more fun moments.
I know you and I are obviously biased because of the fact we spent so long in this particular community, but you're right. There are a lot of great stories, and there are a lot of great men and women who dedicated their professional lives to doing what they needed to do to keep Canada safe. I want to thank you, Ward, for being part of this podcast, and more importantly, I want to thank you for your decades of service to Canada. And I think you stand out as an example of leadership in the service when you were the director for 10 years. And I just want to wish you all the best going forward.
The same to you, Phil. And I have to say it was a real privilege for 10 years. I think we, as an organization, as a group of people, we had a lot of fun, achieved a lot of successes. As I said, most of them you can't talk about very much. Maybe if we had been able, if we could talk about it, people would understand the service does better and national security issues better. But that's the way it is, I guess, with intelligence. It is largely behind the screen. But it was 10 years, and it's an organization of which I was very proud and still am very proud.
Well said. I guess that's one thing I'm trying to do in my so-called retirement is to tell the service story, and we'll see what we can do. So that was it for this podcast. I want to thank people for listening. You can always reach me on email, borealisrisk@gmail.com, or on Twitter @BorealisSafe. You can find me on LinkedIn and on Facebook. You can also subscribe to all the content that is on my webpage. Go to www.borealisthreatandrisk.com. Hit the subscribe button, fill in your information. Love to hear what you think about my conversation with Ward Alcock or any of the information you have. Please get a hold of me and suggest ideas for new podcasts and blogs. I'll talk to you again soon. Stay safe.